Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. Don't live your life on hold with online car insurance that's driven to save you time and money.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're very welcome back once again. Now, we're going to, this man we're going to speak to now, he heads a Limerick-based startup called Provisio, and it's developing unique technology which could save millions of lives, as I've been telling you. We'll come to that in a moment, but he's a fascinating background story and how he got to where he is today. As I said, he's from Limerick. That's where he's live in our RTE studio down there. Good morning to you, Barry Lunn.
Oliver, great to be here from the home of the six in a row Munster champions. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Start already. Six in a row Munster champions, five in a row potentially.
It sounds lovely, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And in fairness, it is nice to see success coming out of Limerick. And I have a theory that there's a lot more successful people in Limerick and famous people from Limerick than there is in Cork. No doubt you will concur with that.
Absolutely. But, you know, we don't like to gloat.
You don't. So let's gloat then, okay, about your whole life story. You start out, obviously, what part of Limerick now, to be precise about, were you from?
Yeah, I'm from Carrickanish, which is a village just outside the city here. So yeah. just out the road. Great, super place to grow up. I'm kind of from the outskirts of the village, so country life upbringing. So yeah, fantastic place.
It was rural at the time you were growing up in it. Probably not so much now, is it?
Yeah, that's very true, actually. Yeah, it felt rural then. It's almost merged into the city at this stage, and like the village has grown 10x. But it's quite funny. I still follow the Ireland team down there, and I still recognise all the family names. So I'm not sure we've assimilated as many of the new people into the community yet.
Little by little, as
little
you.
By little.
What sort of a kid were you in school?
I probably a pain in the backside in one way, but I was a very curious kid. And to be fair, I did well in primary school. Yeah. I would have enjoyed it, and you know, fascinated by things, and I would have been a Lego kid as well. I'd have had a big imagination, you know, that kind of way, and would have liked breaking, I suppose, more than making things. Maybe sometimes
you take things apart, you to find out how they're made, sort of thing.
Oh God, yeah, that'd be my obsession. I'd rather understand how the skeletric set worked than actually drive cars around in circles, you know, that kind of way. So yeah, it was interesting, but it's great. Enjoyed that part of my life for sure.
In secondary school then, you were a little bit more of a tearaway.
Yeah. It didn't work for me. We didn't fit. So I went to school here in the city in Sexton Street, just down the road from me here. And and big school, you know, big class sizes, and and I suppose it was there that I always had this feeling that I was, you know, and people would tell you, you know, that you've got an academic capability, and my performance just didn't match. And that was a very frustrating couple of years. And teachers don't have time to be working out what the hell is wrong with you. And also, you know, I had issues with authority and things like that, you know, that kind of way. So I don't want to disclaim any of that. But
what did that look like?
Just been, you know, you ask a fella to go one way and I'd gone the other, you know, just normal kid stuff, like nothing majorly bad. I would have done a few things that, you know, I like the wind up as well. I like the crack, right? And so sometimes that probably got a bit out of hand, you know, like putting a bolt on the school gates and things like that before the primary school could get out. That kind of stuff that doesn't endear you either, you know what I mean?
Even though there's imagination involved.
There was.
There was a lot of planning.
If I put that work into the schoolwork. But, you know, it was just one of those things. What I didn't know at the time was I'm dyslexic. And that was what it was. I couldn't hit the performance characteristics that I needed to, because I didn't really understand how my brain worked. And all the teachers could see was aptitude, right? And and so it's frustrating for both parties. And by the way, you know, this is the 90s, right? They weren't diagnosing dyslexia in Sexton Street CBS in the 90s. So, look, school of me didn't match, you know, but I dropped out, essentially, you know, in fifth year. And that was it. I just couldn't make it work and went away to get a job. That was kind of it. And eventually found my way back to school.
How did you go back to school?
So I went back again in sixth year, and I had an interesting one when I left. And funnily enough, I was only there yesterday. Analog Devices is a, you know, massive US firm that essentially, you know, it claims to be a Boston company, but it's a headquartered from Limerick. You know what I mean? The CEO's Limerick. The, you know, half the board is Limerick, and so they've been around a long time in Limerick. I went there for a job to work in the fab, you know, and to be fair, got through all the different levels, and eventually got to the final interview with the head of HR. And to be fair, I went into that and it was almost like an intervention. She just set me down. She kind of went, go back to school. Don't go back. You'll regret it. Go back. And so I did go back and I dropped out again. So I'm really good at taking advice. And then eventually what I did was I just did approach a country school, two country schools actually, as it turns out. And I asked, could I do my leaving there? And in fairness, and the reason it was two schools was because I wanted to kind of do art and engineering, which they only did in the tech. And, you know, I wanted to do honours maths, which they only did in the convent kind of thing. So it was a weird one. I've had a habit of asking people for things that you probably shouldn't ask for on retrospect, but sure, you can only ask. And so I ended up doing the leaving that way, kind of side.
You're like the kid in Derry Girls who's the boy who goes to the girls' school.
Oh, my mates are going to get a great kick out of that one. I hope they never hear this.
What's his name? Simon? Is it Simon? Peter? I can't remember. So you go here and there into the convent. You're doing a couple of classes here and there.
Yeah,
working exactly towards your leaving cert, which you do sit in the end.
Which I did sit in the end, yeah. Exactly. And then you come to another crossroads, you know, what next? And that was kind of an interesting one for me as well, because, you know, I talked about the engineering side of my brain and being interested in all that. But at the same time, you know, I had discovered art in the intervening period as well.
Yeah.
And art, I would say, probably saved my life in that period where I dropped out. I was very lucky. I had probably a bit of an intervention from a teacher in the CBS, Joe McGrath, caught me doing graffiti. One of my, another thing on my rap sheet. And to be fair, you know, you can make two decisions, bring him to the principal, but he didn't. He brought me to the art teacher.
Hang on, you're doing graffiti. Wait a second, that's actually quite good.
Yeah, exactly.
poor
Joe tried to make a hurler out of me and discovered we won't pay this into him, but he's actually good at something. So he brought me down to Charlie Donovan and Charlie kind of took me under his wing, because you couldn't do art when you were in the honours maths. It was all that weird stuff back in the 90s. And so I kind of, you know, when I dropped out, I started, you know, getting really into the art side of things. And then, so when it came to choosing college, I kind of got into engineering in UL, and I got into Limerick School of Art and Design. And to be fair, my mum probably had a good influence then. I've always surrounded myself with good mentors, but I was lucky to be born in the house with a very good mentor. And she had a chat with me then and went, you know what, I'm after watching you now for the last number of years, structure and things like that. How good is UL and engineering going to go for you? You know, you love the art, go and enjoy yourself, which is, you know, a working class background. Like, that's not what every man is telling their young fella. And, you know, and fair play to her on that, because it was the best thing I ever did. That's where I really found myself, as they'd say in America. And I really, you know, got to know myself and discovered I wasn't an artist as well.
Yeah, although the art suited the dyslexic brain, as we know now. It does more so, doesn't it, than the structured.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The way you learn in art college is so more suited to every brain, I actually believe. You know what I mean? It's very much self-determined and things like that. And it was obviously in that period as well, I was diagnosed with the dyslexia.
So you knew what was going on.
And half the college is dyslexic. Like, if you go down to the art college, half the college is left-handed and half of them are dyslexic. You know what I mean? We found our tribe, as an answer.
Understood and celebrated now, thankfully.
Yeah.
So after art college, as you said, we know now you didn't become a professional artist or anything like it. What happens then? Who do you meet that again changes the course of where you're going?
Yeah, it was unusual. So I ended up studying design, which suited me much better. And I was kind of if I went to UL, I'd have been an arty fartsy guy. In our college, I was the nerd, you know what I mean? So
I was the
guy in the computer room. The web had emerged at the time, and I just loved like building websites, right? And so that's how I learned to code. Like, I've no great grow for coding, but I learned it because I needed it to fulfill what I needed to do. And at that time, I met two guys that were ex lecturers in the University of Limerick who were very successful entrepreneurs, the Sugru brothers.
Yeah, Dennis and Owen.
Dennis and Owen. There, yeah. yeah, exactly. And like they had kind of come back together doing a new company. And to be fair, they came in, they were looking for a head case, I guess. And they came in and met me and we kind of hit it off. And I became employee number one in that company and moved off to France. And, you know, Dennis was in Russia, Owen was in France. And spent my time between next couple of years between France and Russia working in the aero defence industry. Yeah. Really incredible stuff. And so I was building the front end.
You become the chief executive of this company.
Yeah.
Well, when you start out, you're just out of art college. What are you actually doing? What's your job in the...
Yeah, so I was kind of the market. I was the face of the company, the marketing and the front end of the product guy, really? Right? So basically building what the customer saw, you know, building the front end on the product. And that's a very important, I suppose, thing. They had recognised, they had done all the hardware stuff and they were going, we're not doing that again. We'll buy that from other people, but we'll own what the customer sees. And I suppose I provided that face. And then I was just like very inquisitive. I probably drove him crazy, especially with Owen. You know, he was a really good mentor to me and I just sponged off of him, and that's really when I learned about entrepreneurship as well and starting companies, because I knew nothing about any of that, as you can imagine, you know. And so got to kind of absorb that, which was great. And they let me do then side projects because they recognised in me, you know, this guy needs to do other stuff too. And so I was able to, I did a couple of side projects and spin-offs and things like that. When we discovered kind of new IPs, I would you know, create little companies. And as you say, I eventually became the CEO of that, but you're still wanted to go again, you know.
It's an aerospace company. Who were their customers? What did they do?
Yeah, it was primarily defense test systems for aerospace companies, right? So it would have been basically like if you're going to launch an aircraft, you're going to launch a product that goes into aircraft, things like that. They have to achieve certain standards. We would have essentially defined and built the primary standards. So we did that all over the world. Like we built the primary standards for testing radiometers in China, which is nuts, right? So for the Olympics back in 2008, I believe it was. They basically were doing weather forecasting. We got to build the primary standard for that. So it was really, really cool stuff. Like, it was great fun.
This brought you to China. You were living there for a while.
Yeah, I lived in Shenzhen back in the early 2000s, which was fantastic. Like, that was when China was really emerging. Like, and so, you know, I was, it was super keen, and we were launching there and trying to get going. So yeah, like you learn so much because it's all in one street in China. You know what I mean? There's no differentiation between any part of the product. It's all happening. You can do it all there on the spot, which is really good.
An extraordinary country to try and crack. Coming from a little Limerick company that explodes all around the world. But you're in China, it's a whole different system there, isn't it? Language in particular being barriers.
Absolutely, yeah. And we had to learn the language, which was the first stage, because back then, as well, no one spoke English. So just to eat and live, we had to learn Chinese, and as a dyslexic, that's not easy. So that was a bit of fun. But it was incredible. And yeah, you're right. I mean, trying to crack China, it was so different because most people are buying from China, right? And you look at the success of like PCH, Liam Casey's company, they were there at the same time. But they, you know, in the bar at night, you could tell the difference between the guys who were buying from China and the guys who were trying to sell there, right? Because whoever has the money is the boss in China. So yeah, I was drinking for different reasons today. Where
do you still have? Is a Mandarin you learned?
Yeah, but I'm terrible. I forget things as soon as I learn them. But when I go back, I can survive.
So you're CEO of that company. You're kind of achieving everything. Very young age. Within 10 years, you're the chief executive. So you decide to set up your own company now, which is somewhat related. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So I was seeing the opportunity. We were doing very high frequency testing, and I could see there was this massive opportunity to put that technology onto chips, right? So it was all big, bulky stuff that was being used by the defense industry, right, across the US.
Military, you mean? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And essentially, I was going, what if we brought that onto chip, then we could make it commercial and make it usable for radar in cars or radar on aircraft and, you know, smaller aircraft and things like that. So yeah, that was the kind of idea behind Aralis. So, and the Suguru boys were going, hey, we're not going doing a products company now. So we kind of split off at that stage and went and set up Aralis with a guy called Mike Leaves. We co-founded it. We'd worked together in China. And so that was an interesting one. Like, so we got it onto chip. That was really cool, getting high frequency onto chip. And the market emerged, like, you know, 4G as well, all that, okay. That emerged. And we started working, actually, that's when I started working on autonomous vehicles with that technology, because they saw, oh, we need high fidelity radar on these machines and we're actually failing horribly. But the problem was, even though we got it onto chip, it still was pretty unwieldy. So, like, those radars were, like, started at $100,000, right? So you can imagine how many cars they were going to go on. Now, the autonomous industry didn't mind at the time, right? Because they were spending crazy money on, and they had billions. But at the same time, we knew it wasn't scalable. So, and when you recognize a ceiling, you kind of, that's the time maybe to sell. And so we sold the company.
You sold that company. Yeah. And as I say, I read it in the currency.news from a few years ago. You had enough money never to work again, really, didn't you?
Yeah. If only I had the mentality, but yeah, probably had. Yeah, exactly. There's that. I had that exit velocity.
Did you stop working when you sold the company?
Yeah, no.
Even for a couple of months?
Not really. So unless my wife is listening, and I absolutely did adhere to our agreement of 6 months of no working. It's impossible, right? What happens is I was absolutely, you know, we talked about it, said 6 months, don't do anything, you know, don't do anything stupid. Yeah. And to be fair, I did do that, but what happens is you get caught in other things, right? So I got involved with, you know,
you thought you weren't working, but
exactly. So you get stuck into stuff, and it was great. It was enjoyable, but of course I started working on Provisio straight away, like literally straight away, because once the brain had time to rest, you kind of went, oh, there's a bigger problem here we could tackle.
And this is about the radar technology that you're applying to cars to prevent. To prevent crashes, essentially, is not what you want to do. You mentioned the autonomous industry, because we know the amount of investment has gone in to make cars self-driving. You think they've gone off on the wrong tangent there.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I was working in it. You know what I mean? I'm not, you know, I'm not saying, oh, these guys were all wrong. I was working in it, and I was recognising this isn't going to happen anytime soon. You know what I mean? But I also thought it was a far more interesting problem, right? Like, when you work on that, you start to recognise how many times we crash and how many people are killed, and the global impact of car crashes. Yeah. And so that, to me, seemed like a way more interesting problem, especially, like, where I was in my life, that I could work on problems that I thought were interesting. And so I thought, all right, well, how about we look at that and work up rather than going the other way around? Because I knew, you know, autonomy wasn't going to scale anytime soon. So that's what we started looking at and working out, well, why do we crash? And could we build a kind of a product that could be applied to that, that eventually lead to autonomy? Because you can get to a place where if the robotics in the vehicle are better than the driver, well, then it's an ethical debate, you know, that you'd say, well, the robotics should be driving. So that's what we started building. In Provisio, but key thing to that was these can't be $100,000 sensors, right? They have to be $50 sensors. So what I was doing for $100,000, I needed to do better for $50, and that was the challenge in Provisio.
Have you succeeded?
Yes,
and this company's only, what, 5 years old?
Yeah, 5 years old. It's incredible. It's been an incredible journey. And by the way, you say, have I succeeded? No, I haven't done anything. I put an amazing team together who have succeeded. And that
now you sound like a Limerick hurler.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it is true, right? Like, the only thing I'm good at is creating a place where smart people want to work. And we created that environment, and the guys have just knocked it out of the park. And yeah, it's that type of... Now,
it's 5D perception is the product name, isn't it?
That's it, exactly.
What does that do?
Essentially, right, put yourself in the driving seat, right? The radars are 360 degrees around the vehicle. They're able to see 600 metres out in front, right? So they're able to, and they can tell the velocity, and they can tell what everything is, right? So that's where the AI, the fifth dimension, is, right? The AI is able to go, oh, that's a car, that's a, you know, a tree, let's ignore that. And essentially, it's able to see around corners, and it's able to see multiple cars ahead of you, right? So it's an incredible set. So a human could never have it, right?
The problem of fog is eliminated. contaminated visibility.
Exactly. All of those things. Radar doesn't care about that. That's why it's around since World War II. You know, it doesn't worry about those things. And essentially, yeah, you can see 20 metres in the fog. This can see 600 metres. And essentially what it's doing is it's able to see all of that. And it's able, right now the focus is on driver prompts, right? Make you a better driver. You go to overtake in a silly manoeuvre, it will resist you on the steering wheel. That type
right,
of thing.
Okay.
And eventually, you mentioned fog. In those types of scenarios, they'll be the first scenarios where it'll actually just start to take over the driving, right? Like it just will say, hey, you don't know what you're doing. I'm in charge now.
That makes more sense. So rather than just sitting there with in the passenger seat with nobody in the driver's seat, which is the vision a lot of self-driving companies that are looking for, the likes of Tesla and so on, it's the safety will take over.
Exactly.
To prevent the crash.
Exactly. And the world has changed, by the way, as well, in our favour. And it, like, oh, awful boring thing that I'm sure you weren't up listening to, but, you know, NHTSA, which is the safety authority in the US, recently brought in FMVSS 127, rolls off the tongue. But essentially, for the very first time, active safety is mandated in vehicles. So from 2029, you cannot sell a vehicle in the US without this technology. So that's an incredible thing, right? And the EU have done incredible work as well. There's robotics now. You can't build a car in Europe without robotics built in around, you know, speed limit recognition, things like that. So this stuff is all coming in. Like, we kind of predicted it was going to happen 5 years ago, but our time is now, right? So if we screw this up, it's on me, right? The team have done amazing work. If we screw it up, it's because I couldn't get it to market.
The technology has to go in, and you're the world leader on this.
Yeah, absolutely. In this area, absolutely. I've seen nothing, and we're getting that confirmed by the, like, we're working with literally the top five in the world in every aspect of this.
Really? And this is all happening from Ireland?
It's happening. Look, we've guys in the US and we've a big team in Belfast, and then we've a bunch of guys around Europe. But yeah, primarily, you know, we've a test bed out in Shannon, the Future
which
Mobility
will be
Campus.
With the fog, I presume.
Exactly. We do tend to get every weather out there, which is great when customers come to visit. But yeah, we've an incredible setup here. So yeah, really happy to be in Ireland, to be honest.
It's an extraordinary story. When will we actually see, or will we know when this technology is in the cars? I know you mentioned 2029. That's the mandated. Is that the target date for when it's going to...
That's the target date for ubiquitous, i.e. in every car.
Everywhere, okay.
Exactly. So it'll start to filter in before that. But, you know, production, like automotive, it's a time suck, right? So once you get a design win, it's still 3 years till that car goes into production.
Right.
You know what I mean? So basically...
Do you have to get car manufacturing partners now at this stage then to buy this technology from you? Is that how it works?
Absolutely. And then there's tier ones are the guys that sell to them, like household names like Continental, Bosch, Denso. These are massive companies. Most of them are bigger than the actual car makers, right? Yeah. So you partner with those guys, and that's how you get into the vehicle, and then, you know, there's all that. So that'll take the next couple of years, but we're feeling very positive. And that, the industry is in a bit of flux at the minute, you know, the automotive industry. So, you know, we have to be conscious of that, but yeah.
It's an incredible story, Barry Lund. Thanks a million for sharing with us this morning. You mentioned your wife there, that's Shelley, who you met in the convent, by the way, when you were the Derry girl, Derry boy.
I did. She wasn't a nun, for clarity,
she
right? She was
yes,
the same age as me. Yeah, she was in school too. Yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
Thanks a million. It's a fascinating story, and more success to you and your team at Previsio around the world. And thanks a million.
Thanks for having me, Oliver. Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Back after these.
Email oliver@rte.ie.